I am delighted to announce that my friend and colleague, Robert E. Crossler, better known as Rob, is going to be joining as a co-host on AI Goes to College, starting with this episode. Rob is a professor of information systems at the Carson College of Business at Washington State University, where he's chair of the Department of Management Information Systems and Entrepreneurship. He's been published all over the place. He's a distinguished member of the Association for Information Systems, cum laude, which is kind of a big deal. Rob has held a bunch of different leadership roles in our field, and he's a very knowledgeable guy, not only as an expert teacher and world-renowned researcher, and as a department chair, he's also very familiar with all of the administrative tasks that take place around a university. So Rob's going to be a great addition, and best thing for you is that you're not going to have to listen to me as much, I suppose. All right, welcome, Rob, and let's get to it. Welcome to AI Goes to College, the podcast that helps higher education professionals navigate the changes brought on by generative AI. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Van Slyke. The podcast is a companion to the AI Goes to College newsletter. You can sign up for the newsletter at aigoestocollege.com/newsletter. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of AI Goes to College. Today, we've got three topics for you, starting off with the big set of announcements from OpenAI that were countered by Google the next day. We'll talk about Google at another time. Today, we want to talk about OpenAI's set of announcements. The big piece was the announcement of GPT-4 Omni, which is 4.0, but not for number 0. It's for lowercase letter O, which is just going to be confusing for all of us for a while. The idea behind GPT-4.0 is that it's faster, and it is much faster. It will eventually have a larger context window, which means it can remember more stuff. And it's supposed to require fewer resources to run, which isn't a big deal for any individual user, but it's a big deal from an environmental standpoint and for OpenAI and their cost of running it. There's a lot you can do. You can upload multiple files and query those files. You can chat about photos, which is really kind of interesting. In the next week or so, I'm going to put up a cute little example that, of course, involves animals. And you can do lots of other things. The other big piece that got a lot of people excited, or one other big piece, was the enhancements to the voice capabilities. And the idea is that it's going to be much more human-like. I'm not sure that that's really rolled out entirely yet, but that will make it more like a conversation where you can interrupt the chatbot and that sort of thing. Rob, I don't know if you saw this. I just saw it in the news that they took one of the favorite voices down because it was too close to Scarlett Johansson, to her voice. So that it was Sky. So they just kind of put Sky on pause. And so I'm sure the interwebs will be in an uproar.
Yeah, it's funny how that works, right? The unintended consequences of these new things that we implement.
I'm not sure I would recognize her voice if I heard it, but okay. There's also going to be a Mac OS app, which frustratingly I've been able to download and install, but do not have access to yet. And then they're making most of these, at least some of these features, including GPT-4.0, available to everybody, not just to paid users. Another little feature that I think might be handy from time to time is you can change models in mid-conversation now, which it could come in handy sometimes. I'm not so sure that'll be a huge step forward, but it's kind of nice. So, Rob, there is a lot going on. What do you think is the most significant for those of us in higher ed?
I'm most excited about the fact that it's free. One of my concerns with the ChatGPT-4 versus ChatGPT-3.5 has been creating an issue of the haves versus the have-nots. And if you can afford the better version, you had a leg up on others. So as I look at this, the thing that I got most excited about was the fact that if I want to use this in the classroom, I don't have to struggle with asking everybody to pay $20 a month for a subscription fee, or, you know, how do we figure out a way to bake it in as a class fee so it's covered by financial aid stuff, or how do we find a donor who's willing to support it? by making this available, it really does take away that struggle of, am I creating a burden for a student where college is already a burden for them to attend?
Yeah, I think this is a huge step in the right direction. So I agree with you 100%. Although, to be clear, there are still going to be some differences between the paid and the free versions. The big thing with the big part of the announcement for the free version is that access to 4 Omni, which is huge, So are you going to keep your
I actually turned it off, Rob? To see what life was like without it. So I want to see what changed and what is the free version like. So I'm going to use it for a while and just see. I look at a lot of these things that come with generative AI technologies and these changes as an opportunity to experiment and to learn and with a view towards what's possible. And then I'll let that inform, you know, where I'm going to be next August when students are back on campus and we're starting to engage again, because I will not be surprised if there's more changes before we get to August.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This is kind of an aside. I've always been of the opinion that if you only had $20 to spend and you're not very technically sophisticated, a subscription to Po.com is a way to go, because it gives you access to all of the open AI models that you can get at with ChatGPT, the Gemini models, Llama. And last time I counted, it was almost 30 models that you had access to for $20 a month. It's got some downsides to it, but it's really not a bad thing to check out if you are limited in what you can spend on these sorts of tools. One of the things that makes me temper my enthusiasm just a little bit is that the free version is going to have like 20% of the usage cap of the paid version. But I'm not so sure that Omni is going to be necessary for most of what our students are going to want to do. So we'll just have to, like you said, we're going to have to sit back and see.
I'm looking forward to playing with it to see what does it take for me to hit that cap and what are the restrictions of hitting it and how does all that work? Because I think understanding, you know, in pragmatic, real life sort of use, exactly how that happens is going to be telling. So in my free time this summer and how I'm going to explore and play with this, one of the things I plan on doing.
And I should have mentioned Poe also gives access to the Claude models, which are quite good. My experience has been that hitting the usage cap seems to be pretty inconsistent. So I've used it intensively and not hit the cap. And then, 2 days later, I'm using it in a lot lighter way and I hit the cap. So I would imagine it has something to do with the resource load that they have. But as Rob said, stay tuned because, you know, whatever's going on now, it'll be different in a few months, which brings us to the second topic. Rob, how in the world do you keep up with all of the developments in AI?
Great question. And I can honestly say I'm not certain I'm perfect at doing that, right? There is so much that comes down that I try to read about it on a daily basis, what is hitting in the AI technology. When the main players release video feeds, I'll listen to them. But in a lot of ways, what you see when these things are released is it's so much, here are all the grand, great things it can do. And I'm not sure what is beyond the hype, right? If you think about a salesperson, their job is to sell you on how great the next new thing is. So that's why I want to take the time to touch them, to play with them, to see what's going on, to know if the hype is real or if it's just trying to convince people to pick whichever company was releasing as the winner of the new technology.
Yep. Yep. And before we keep going, it's worthwhile for me to give a plug to AI Goes to College, the podcast and the newsletter, both of which are available at AIGoesToCollege.com. If you want to subscribe to the newsletter, there's a form, or you can go, there's a link to the Substack for AI Goes to College at AIGoesToCollege.com/newsletter. Because one of the reasons that we do what we're doing today is to try to help you all stay up with the most important of these. So it wouldn't surprise me if between the two of us, we probably look at 15 or more newsletters a week, in addition to surfing and YouTube channels and all of that sort of thing. So we can help a little bit with this. But you touched on a couple of things that I think we ought to explore. One is you used hype, but I want to go a step further and call it hysteria. So there's a hype on kind of the vendor side and the AI proponent side, all these great things it's going to do, most of which won't be true in the near term. But there's also this hysteria that the world is going to end. I don't mean that literally, like existentially, but the world of higher ed is going to be massively different. And, you know, people are going to lose their jobs and we're not going to need faculty anymore. And they're going to have us teaching, those of us who remain, we're going to teach 1,000 students, you know, a class and blah, blah, blah. So what do you think about all of
that? I would agree with the idea of hysteria. I'd also agree with the idea that it gets wearing, right? It wears you out, fatigue, if you will. And as I've just paid attention to it, I think of Chicken Little, and you kind of mentioned, you know, the world's going to end, but the sky is falling, right? Every time you turn around, the sky is falling, which leads to a level of fatigue, especially if you're in this space.
Yeah.
And you're trying to figure out, well, what does this mean to me in my classroom? Depending on the voices you're listening to, you might actually come to that conclusion that the sky is falling. But I think the reality is different. I think we have to pay attention and we have to adapt. But much like any other new tool that comes out, there are risks and there are benefits, right? There are some great benefits to doing some things with this generative AI technology, but there are risks of doing it wrong. There's risks of throwing everything that we know and that we're good at out the window in order to adjust this new technology. The big takeaway I have as I think about how I do my courses is there's a new tool that's on the market. And there's a new tool that all of my students should be equipped and know how to use, which is no different when I taught a Microsoft Excel class back in the day. It was a tool that students needed to know how to use in order to be successful at their job. Very quickly, we've gotten a new tool that is going to be crucially important for our students to use, and it's emerged on the market in some incredible ways. But if we step back and we think about it, it's how do I empower, how do I enable, how do I equip students to utilize a new tool to give themselves that competitive advantage in the marketplace? Then in a lot of ways, it's not a whole lot different than when we introduced other new tools in the past.
Yeah, I think one of the differences, though, is that this tool is so massively flexible. I think that's a fundamental difference. And you and I have talked about this before, not to go into the research weeds, but, you know, a tool is what you make of it. We have a thing in the research world we call affordances. So a rock is a weapon if a predator is coming after you. But if you've got something in the pasture that you need to nail in, it becomes a hammer. Or it can help control erosion, or it can be a decoration. And so generative AI is kind of like that. It can do really serious things. It can do silly things. It can, you know, help you with an almost infinite variety of tasks. And I think that's part of what leads to some of the hysteria and some of the fatigue is just trying to get your head around all of that. Forget about, you know, the almost daily developments of new tools and changes to the underlying models and, you know, the latest way to cheat with AI. And all of those kinds of things, but just trying to figure out what it is in terms of what it does is enough to make your kind of head explode.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And that's where I think being okay with giving yourself the time to figure out how does these changes affect what I want to do and to ultimately walk through it purposefully and not reactively helps you to get to a place where you can be comfortable using it. And I've talked to a lot of different faculty members who are in different places with how they're utilizing generative AI. Some people who are trying to push themselves to be at the cutting edge of exactly what it can do and how to completely revamp what they're doing in the classroom. And other people who are looking for little ways to begin engaging, to still be teaching those same concepts, but to do so in a purposeful way that brings in some of these technologies and some of these tools. And that's what I would encourage everyone to do is at least a little bit, start to think about that. How can I do something, but without feeling like you have to completely change the way that you've been doing everything for the last 20 plus years, perhaps?
Yeah. Well, and to move it away from just being focused on faculty and teaching, I think for those people in the audience that are in more administrative jobs, it's the same kind of thing. You don't have to change everything you're doing today. I'm a big fan of the low-hanging fruit approach. You know, learn enough to where you can see a few things that might be really useful, and then kind of put those into your routine. And then as you learn how to do those effectively with AI, you'll see some other opportunities and just let it expand almost organically. Don't try to do everything at once. You'll just make yourself crazy, especially with the rate of change. So to kind of say what you said in a little bit different way, take a deep breath, relax. It's probably all going to be okay. Notice the probably. It's all going to be okay. And you don't need to do all of this at once. because you will make yourself crazy trying to stay up with all of it and trying to change too many things at any given time.
The other thing I would add to that, Craig, is take the time to listen to the stakeholders that are involved with what you're doing. Whether you're the faculty member and you're making changes and there's impact from the students have a different perspective than you do, and there's some value there. But from an administrative role, if you're doing some things to try to make things more efficient from the perspective of people in student services that are advising students, that are answering questions, you know, take the time to listen to those advisors and to those people and to incorporate that into what your approach is, because I don't think there is a magical solution that we just know what it is. There's going to be trial and error. There's going to be things that work the way we expected it would. And there'll be a lot of things that didn't work. But being able to listen and to hear that and to adjust, I think, is the only way to truly be successful as you begin utilizing some of these new technologies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So I want to kind of close this segment by pointing out that, and Rob, tell me if this is not making sense, because it's kind of forming in my brain. One of the points about making this a chat-based interface is to make it friendlier. So you don't have to know Python. You don't have to know how to code. You don't have to learn an application programming interface, API. You just go in and do what a lot of us do every day, and you just chat. And I really like that. I think that's one of the reasons that ChatGPT took off so quickly, is because you didn't really have to know a lot to be able to use it. Now, using it really well, using it ethically, you know, it gets a little bit more complicated, but for its basic use, it's not that hard. And so that brings me to our third topic. I think one of the most unfortunate aspects of this whole generative AI world that's come out in the last year and a half or so is somehow people started using this term prompt engineering. And I think it now it's really a thing. And in some circumstances, it can be the right thing. But for the vast majority of the people that are going to use these tools, it's the wrong way to think about it. So I'm, and Rob, we're starting to advocate for something called prompt design, which, and Rob, what I want to do is kind of run through what I mean by that and see what your reaction is. So prompt engineering is a scary word. I was an engineering major for 3 years before I decided I didn't really like engineering. And it was literally the look to your left, look to your right, you know, two of you won't be here at the end of the term. You know, low grades, high fail out rates, high burnout rates. Engineering is hard. So imagine you're talking to somebody and say, oh, you know, you need to learn prompt engineering to use AI. It's going to be like, well, screw that. I'm not an engineer and I don't want to be one. No disrespect to engineers. But engineers are highly trained people. You know, they go through, they've got, if you're a professional engineer, you've got strict licensing exam requirements and ongoing education requirements. It's a really technical discipline. It's also really precise. So, you know, you plug formulas or you plug numbers into a formula and you get a precise answer. When I was in the engineering world, you know, we'd take things down to two or three decimal places fairly routinely. So all of that is not indicative of what we do with generative AI. You know, we go in, you don't need to know a lot. You start chatting. You try to get kind of close. You refine it as you go along. It's really iterative and kind of emergent. It's not precise. You know, you put the same prompt in three times in a row, you're going to get three, at least slightly different answers. So to me, all of that is much better captured with the idea of design. You know, design is a little bit messy. Like I said, it's iterative. You go down these paths that don't really work very well, but that helps you learn some things to where your ultimate design is really good. It's nonlinear. It's imprecise.
Yeah, well, what do you think, Craig? Prompt engineering? This prompting with generative AI is more art than it is science. And that the exploration, the curiosity, the as you change the wording of your prompt is going to give you different outputs. And it's through that art of exploration that you're going to come up with the prompts that resulted in your solution. And that each time you utilize the tools, you're going to go through a different process that will ultimately help you to take the output you're getting and make it useful.
So you could have saved everybody 2.5, 3 minutes if you would have just interrupted me and said that as soon as I got started, because you said it in a much better way.
Well, it took your inspiring words, Craig, to get me there.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess the big message is don't let prompt engineering scare you. And I really am going to start trying to use prompt design in my classes and when I'm giving talks and that kind of thing, it's going to be forget about prompt engineering, although there is space for that. So if you're doing something that needs to be really repeatable, very precise, you're going to deploy it broadly. Like, you know, let's say you're doing a customer service chat bot. You need to engineer that, but that's for the experts. You know, that's not for those of us who are using this more or less casually, even if it's seriously, it's not, you know, we're not trying to dig into it to that level. So that's why I'm going to really start.
And what I would encourage too, Craig, is as people are designing these prompts and getting different outputs, to begin creating a prompt library where they capture kind of the essence of what prompts they used and the sort of output they got, they received, and then how happy they were with those outputs. So that way, as they're doing things in the future, they don't have to reinvent the wheel, and it'll help them to go back and be like, yeah, in this particular environment where I was doing this work or I was doing this thing for fun, I want to do something similar. They can refresh themselves, remind themselves of what sort of prompts they used that got them there, which should help them to be more efficient to get kind of back into that same zone of the sort of output they're receiving when they do something different but related.
Yeah, or even if you're going to do that, or maybe even more so, if you're going to do the same thing again. Like, I'll give you a quick example where I'm giving my final exam in the morning. Well, I want to make sure that there are no duplicate questions on the final exam, and then I want to make sure it matches my study guide. I have a deal with my students. If it's not on the study guide, it's not on the test. They're different form for the questions, and there's a lot more on the study guide than I could put on a test. But that's a perfect use for something like generative AI. Literally put both documents in, do this with a test, match it up against the study guide, tell me where. I also ask it for to flag any unclear questions. Well, I'm going to do that every test now. So instead of what I hear you saying, instead of reinventing that wheel every time, once I get the process, and I think this is an important part of it, once you get the process down, put that in a notepad file and an Apple Notes file and a Google Doc, whatever you use, and then just copy and paste. So I think that's great advice. But also, just to make sure nobody missed it, Rob's also saying when you do something similar. So, you know, a lot of our tasks are variations of the same theme, but they're not exactly the same thing. So yeah, you can adapt as you go along. Of course, then they'll change the models.
Well, it's when they change the models, it gives you the opportunity to say, do I like this new thing that came out better or worse? Because you can go back and kind of do the same exact thing and say, you know what? My reaction to what I'm getting now is this was a step backwards, or this was a step in the right direction. I really like it. I'm looking forward to using these new things.
Great. Great. All right. Well, I think we're close to a wrap. Anything you want to add?
All I would say is
to any of what we've talked
theme
about
from this episode that I think will probably be a theme from a lot of our episodes is keep exploring, keep playing, keep experimenting and having fun with these new technologies. No one's judging you. And unless you share your results, people aren't going to know the creativity you use to get to the place where you found something useful. So feel free to play with these things and see how they're helpful to you.
And that's really the best way to learn a new technology is to play. All right, great. Well, as we wrap up, anything you want us to dig into, let us know. You can email me at craig@aigoestocollege.com. You can use the contact form at aigoestocollege.com. And we are going to be rolling out and have rolled out some videos, some what I'm calling lo-fi kind of one-take videos on things we're doing with AI at our YouTube channel, which you got it. It's called AI Goes to College. There'll be links for all of that in the show notes. And thank you very much. We are out. Talk to you next time. Thanks for listening to AI Goes to College. If you found this episode useful, you'll love the AI Goes to College newsletter. Each edition brings you useful tips, news, and insights that you can use to help you figure out what in the world is going on with generative AI and how it's affecting higher ed. Just go to aigoestocollege.com to sign up. I won't try to sell you anything, and I won't spam you or share your information with anybody else. As an incentive for subscribing, I'll send you the Getting Started with Generative AI guide. Even if you're an expert with AI, you'll find the guide useful for helping your less knowledgeable colleagues.